Asia Catalyst is perhaps one of the most unique U.S.-based nonprofits working in China. Founded and headed by Sarah Meg Davis, a former China researcher at Human Rights Watch, Asia Catalyst is doing what others might think is unsexy work, but in reality is perhaps the most necessary work, assisting Chinese grassroots NGOs with developing the skills and best practices to become effective organizations. While foreign academics study the growth of civil society and hypothesize about its future development, only Asia Catalyst is on the ground in China, assisting Chinese grassroots NGOs with the nitty-gritty, developing appropriate budgeting that can pass an audit, training advocates on how to draft effective advocacy pieces that can be used both domestically and internationally, and through its pay-it-forward philosophy, developing a Chinese network of support for civil society. As Asia Catalyst celebrates its fifth anniversary, China Law and Policy sat down with Meg Davis to discuss its work, its future, and what it sees for the interplay between law and civil society in China. Thank you for joining us today, Meg. So 5 years ago, what inspired you to create Asia Catalyst?
It was really a kind of exciting moment in the development of Chinese civil society. We're starting to see a lot of small groups springing up around the country to address health issues and environmental issues. And these were groups that were started by charismatic individuals who had a clear vision for the future, but maybe hadn't worked at a nonprofit before or had just worked at a similar kind of a grassroots startup. And it was the fact that I had worked with some of these folks at Human Rights Watch in my capacity as a researcher there that led me to have relationships with them. And so when I left Human Rights Watch, they didn't really let me leave, like kind of followed along and said, can you look at this grant proposal and can you help me to meet with this UN person and, you know, I'm at risk of arrest, can I sleep on your sofa for a week? So it was a lot of that kind of stuff that eventually led to the development of Asia Catalyst.
And just in terms of the grassroots situation in China, you keep referring to these NGOs that you work with as grassroots NGOs. Can you perhaps just explain a little bit more about the NGO structure in China and how these grassroots NGOs that you help fit into that structure?
Yeah, grassroots is really an English appropriation of a Chinese term, caogun. A lot of the groups that we work with refer to themselves as caogun, as grassroots groups, and it's their way of saying that they're independent. In China, you can only really register at this stage as a nonprofit if you have, in most parts of the country, a sponsoring government institution. And for groups that do policy advocacy, no sensible government official is going to stick their necks out and sponsor one of these groups to get registered. A lot of them are unregistered, and a lot of them are also registered as businesses, as commercial enterprises.
Okay. And if these groups are unregistered with the government, how do they develop the skills? Like, if you're not there to help them, how would they develop the skills to become a professional and effective organization without you? I mean, if they're kind of in the shadows.
Some groups that are more established are getting support from capacity-building organizations that do exist in China. There aren't many people who are offering what we provide to these very small startups, which is really one-on-one tailored coaching. A lot of the groups we work with are founded by people with very limited education, and so we're developing tools that don't require sophisticated vocabulary that they can use to do strategic planning, budgeting, staff management. They can do very basic human rights research and without, you know, a sophisticated background.
Mm-hmm. And just in terms of Asia Catalyst's focus, you're focusing right now on which types of grassroots NGOs? I mean, because I imagine there's a lot of grassroots NGOs. Which ones are you focusing on?
Yeah, there's more every year. We mostly work with groups involved in health and human rights or health and legal rights, and that includes groups working on HIV/AIDS, so marginalized communities, including lesbian and gay groups, sex workers, drug users, people living with HIV. But we're starting also to work with groups that work on disability rights, and with groups working on pollution and other kinds of health-related issues.
And what caused you 5 years ago just to focus on health rights groups?
It was an area of growth, and I think it's also an area where forward-thinking, progressive government officials can easily engage. If you go to them and say, we want to support human rights groups that are working on democracy promotion or censorship issues, that's hard for someone who's a devout believer in the Communist Party ideals support. But someone who is a socialist can get behind health rights because it really is not that far removed.
And so today, 5 years in, how many organizations in China does Asia Catalyst currently partner with? And how does Asia Catalyst find its partners?
Currently this year, we're working with, I think, about 17 organizations around the country. They're from all over the place, from northeast China all the way down to Yunnan and southeast China as well. And we find most of our partners through online open applications. And we do this because when I was starting Asia Catalyst, I found that there were a growing number of NGOs, but there was a very small number that had international partners or international funding. And we really wanted to cast a wider net and get groups that maybe not everybody had heard about. And I think we're starting to do that.
So just to follow up on that, I mean, that's one of the things I find most exciting about Asia Catalyst is this open call for applications. I know you have a report on your website about how you put out an open call and that people can just come in. I know most U.S.-based organizations do partner with Chinese organizations that have been recommended through other people, so a lot of the same organizations are getting support internationally. And sometimes some of those organizations, the U.S. organizations, believe that it's because these organizations are more reliable. But by opening your application process just to the public, do you feel that you risk spending resources on grassroots NGOs that might not be as reliable and might just disappear? Or, you know, what has your experience been?
It's actually, our experience is the opposite. Our experience is that some people who become, frankly, kind of donor favorites don't necessarily have very strong infrastructure, don't have a core team, don't have a strategic plan or a solid budget, don't necessarily have strong financial controls. And so by throwing the application process completely open, it's a little bit more democratic, it's a little bit more, you know, in line with the ideals that we espouse of transparency and accountability. And it means that groups, any group that applies for one of our programs, has to go through a process of being vetted, which is quite intensive and actually a little bit painful for them. They have to submit a lot of materials, they have to go through multiple interviews, they have to provide references. And in that way, we try to identify groups that have certain fundamentals, and one of those is a core team. It's easy to have one person who's a very charismatic founder, but that doesn't necessarily mean that there's an organization behind them. We learned that the hard way. And so that's one of the things that we try to identify through our intake process.
And after you've done the intake and you find an organization that's been vetted, what kind of services does Asia Catalyst provide to help develop them?
The way our program is structured now, the first kind of level of engagement is through our nonprofit leadership cohort, which is a year-long program where 10 health rights groups get intensive training in budgeting, strategic planning, volunteer management, and advocacy planning. And out of that, we pick two people who will continue on for a second year who will then become training assistants with a small stipend. And at the end of the second year, if they pass a certification exam, they could start their own cohorts using our curriculum, which we're developing now. Groups that go through the cohort then become eligible to get other kinds of assistance, and sometimes that means leveraging our own donor connections to introduce them to donors. Sometimes it means helping them come to international conferences. So it can mean a variety of different possible partnerships.
And I also know that you guys have this survival skills guide. Now, is that accessible to Chinese NGOs in Chinese on the web, or?
It is. It's available in English and in Chinese. We circulated hard copies through our networks in China, and then we've also made it available for free download. And that's actually the most popular thing we've developed, is that toolkit, which uses tools we've developed with groups over the past 5 years.
And that's accessible to all grassroots organizations in China?
Absolutely. Any of them. And also our human rights curriculum, which we're still in the process of developing with Chinese and Thai partners, which is called Know It, Prove It, Change It, and is a three-part curriculum series on how to analyze human rights issues, how to document them, and how to conduct advocacy around them.
And then the organizations that you work with in China, I know you have this philosophy of pay it forward, where they're supposed to help others. Can you just talk more about that and how you make sure that happens?
Yeah, that was something that came out of our initial partnership with the Coricata AIDS Law Center in Beijing. And after we had worked with them for a couple of years and they were ready to become independent, we asked them for some input into our strategic plan, and they said, how about a pay it forward element, where we would then help another organization with some element of their work. So some of the groups that we work with now that have had a little bit more experience, we ask them to assist with some of the other organizations, okay, whether it's advising on a project or giving them a little workshop or something else.
So then they're like creating like a real civil society where other organizations in China teach other organizations.
That's the hope.
That's cool. So I just want to also now turn to some of the more the substantive work that Asia Catalyst has published and co-authored, and specifically the March 2012 report that Asia Catalyst co-authored with Kolkata AIDS Law Center entitled China's Blood Disaster, The Way Forward. Can you just give our listeners a little bit of background on the report, what role Asia Catalyst played in drafting the report, and how Kolkata was able to obtain the information for that report?
Sure. I think as most people who follow China at all know, in the 1990s, tens of thousands of people contracted HIV through a state-sponsored for-profit blood collection scheme in which people were encouraged to sell their blood in ways that were unsafe and that spread blood to whole villages of people, tainted blood to whole villages of people. 10, 15 years further down the line, a lot of those people are struggling with HIV and are still trying to get compensation and still trying to get some acknowledgement of what happened to them and their families, some of whom suffered just overwhelming losses. It's really the largest blood disaster in the history of AIDS. China has had one, and certainly the U.S., Canada, France, Japan, every country's had a blood disaster, but China dwarfs the others by scales of, you know, vast magnitude. So activists and people living with HIV in China have been pushing through petitioning and through lawsuits to try and get compensation. The weak legal system in China has made it difficult for them. But in the past year or so, we've got some signals that the government and the UN system might be willing to engage on this issue and to address this vast need by creating a national compensation plan. And we were asked by UNAIDS to work with Kolkata AIDS Law Center as they conducted research to document some of the cases. It's not possible to document all of them when you're a tiny little NGO, but to gather some of the cases from different parts of the areas that were affected and to show what some of the challenges were with obtaining compensation. So Kolkata conducted several dozen interviews. They got very rich testimony from people in very remote villages. And I worked with them in training them in how to do the research and then how to analyze the data. Mm-hmm. We had a week of eating dumplings around a table and arguing about how a compensation fund should be managed, which was one of the most fun things I've ever done. You know, imagine trying to make policy for a country of 1.2 billion. If you're not someone who's already doing it, it's a challenging task. And based on that, they drafted a report, which we then translated into English and was submitted to UNAIDS and to what's called the Red Ribbon Forum, which is a national platform for dialogue on this issue.
Red Ribbon Forum is a national platform, is that a national platform within China?
Or? It is. It's unique, actually, and they've kept it a little bit quiet, but it's basically, as far as I know, the first platform in which the government and NGOs engage in a dialogue about human rights, and it's about human rights and HIV/AIDS.
And just in terms, when you say the government and NGOs, mm-hmm, including these grassroots NGOs that are kind of in the shadows.
Absolutely. It's grassroots NGOs and it's the Ministry of Health. And when I say dialogue, it's often Ministry of Health officials giving a speech and then NGOs giving a speech. So it's not really a very hands-on discussion a lot of the time, but it is a first to have them in the same room and talking to each other. Out of that, there was a working group sponsored by the government that then created proposals that went to the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, which met in March. And so there's a proposal now for a national compensation fund that's in that process. So we'll see.
So this report has basically gone to the high levels of the Chinese government and hopefully has some kind of impact.
Right, so I've written a lot of human rights reports in China, but that's the first one.
And in terms of the report outside of the Chinese government, I know you received coverage with the South China Morning Post, but domestically, has the report received any media coverage in China, or is this issue still a little bit too sensitive for, I guess, how is the media handling the report and then just the issue in general?
We did what's called a soft launch, so we didn't send it out to all our press contacts, and Kolkata also did not, because it was the Lianghui, the two sessions period, mm-hmm, which is often politically sensitive. Mm-hmm. So we opted to do something that was a little bit more low-key and just sent it to a few key people that we knew were interested in the issue and that would cover it. So the beautiful article in South China Morning Post, the British Medical Journal, and then, as it happens, the Shenzhen CDC, Center for Disease Control, also reported on it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, so this is having a lot of impact then. In terms of the report itself, when I read through it, what I thought was most interesting as an attorney was just the difficulty that many of these people have in getting into the court system for their compensation cases. So can you just explain to our audience how these cases are kept out of court?
Sure. What's happened in Hunan province is that courts have flat out refused to accept cases. So a lawyer will approach the court, say that he wants or she wants to submit a case for consideration, and the court clerk will just take it and then bring it back to him and say, sorry, we cannot accept this case because it relates to HIV/AIDS. And in Hunan, courts are saying that they've been issued an order from on high not to handle any cases relating to HIV/AIDS of any kind.
Mm-hmm. And have you ever seen this actual order, or is
no
it just all verbal?
No one has seen it. Okay. No one's ever seen this order.
And Hunan is kind of the epicenter of the crisis.
Hunan is the hardest hit province in the whole region.
So what I thought actually was really interesting is that in your report, you actually had a list of 26 AIDS HIV compensation settlements where you document whether it was out-of-court settlement or an in-court settlement or a court judgment. And there were actually six cases where it was either a court-mediated settlement or a court judgment. And they actually had the highest awards when I compared it to others.
Right.
And even in one of them, I thought that was what was really interesting, the one in out of Heilongjiang ordered over $30,000 for emotional damages.
Heilongjiang is a good person to be a victim of a bad thing.
But why are some courts taking these cases, or do you not know?
So Heilongjiang was very early on. It's a northeastern province in China, very sparsely populated. There was not a big blood disaster there.
Mm-hmm.
And so some provinces like Hunan, you know, it's tens of thousands of people.
Right.
Heilongjiang, it may be a few thousand or it may be less. We don't really know. And so I think what's happening is that early on some provinces said, oh, you know, fine, no problem, let's address this. But other provinces said, we're going to open the floodgates and we cannot cope with this. And that's part of the reason why we're calling for a national compensation fund is because it's been so
Because you're seeing such a disparity between provinces.
Yeah, it's deeply unfair.
Do you know, I mean, it was kind of unique. I mean, as an attorney, seeing a judge give out a huge amount of money for emotional harm is even unique in the United States, let alone in China. Do you have any idea why?
I don't, and nobody's been able to reach the lawyer in that case, so we don't know all the details.
Oh, that's interesting.
That was a case that happened fairly early on also, and so it gave a lot of people false hope, I think, in other places.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And in terms of, like, new cases, I know you had reported, Asia Catalyst had reported on its blog this past week that there's been a new case that a court has actually accepted about AIDS, HIV, and privacy. Do you think this is a result of publicizing the issue more, or what do you think is happening there?
I don't know. There have been a few attempts to litigate on discrimination, and this was actually sort of like a discrimination case.
Okay.
And so I think there's starting to be a little bit more awareness, and more courts are accepting cases related to discrimination, and privacy issues are probably an easier sell.
Okay.
But the blood disaster remains very, very hard to litigate on in China.
Okay. So it sounds like in a short amount of time, Asia Catalyst has been able to assist a good number of grassroots NGOs achieve justice for some of society's most vulnerable. What do you see for the next 5 years?
Well, we are continuing to build on our work in China, and some of the groups that come out of the cohort will be working with them to help them conduct their own research and do advocacy, and hopefully building a system that will then self-perpetuate, in which people who come out of our program start to train others, and it becomes really something that's a locally managed and scaled up kind of project. We're also beginning to look at Myanmar and at other countries in Southeast Asia to see whether we can take the tools and the experience that we have from China and make them work in other locations as well. So we'll see how that develops.
Okay, well, that's very exciting. It's exciting times for Asia Catalyst, and thank you for joining us today, Meg.
Thank you so much.